Vopal Network is the bomb, the cutting edge of geekdom. Comics, advice, D&D, movies, video games, RPGs. Finding it's easy, just stay calm. VorpalNetwork.com.
This episode of The Tome Show is sponsored by Noble Knight Games, where Out of Print is available again. And listeners like you, thanks for using The Tome's Amazon store. Welcome to the Tome Book Club for August 2011. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interviews show, and I'm your Tome host, Tracy Hurley.
And I'm your co-host, Jeff Greiner. In each book club episode, we discuss one D&D-related novel, spoilers be damned, in full book club style. And our book for this month was Midnight's Mask, Book 3 in the Erebus Kale Trilogy. Joining us later on is the author, Paul S. Kemp. He's been gracious enough to join us for all three of the books of the trilogy. And so now I think we'll just jump right into it, and let's talk Midnight's Mask. Tracy, what'd you think?
I think it was pretty good. It reminded me a little bit of Leverage, though.
Of Leverage?
Yeah, I don't know if you've seen the TV show.
I've seen the first two seasons.
Okay, so you know that a lot of times there's these things happening in the background between the characters that we don't know about. So we're suddenly like, how is this going to work? And then they show us. And I felt a little bit that way with the plan that they had between Riven and Kale and them.
Well, which plan is that?
That they blanked out Riven's mind so that he wouldn't even remember that he was secretly really helping them still.
Sure. You're going all the way back to the beginning of the book, which totally makes sense. I wasn't there because I was in my head at the end of the book, because that's what I most recently read, right?
Right.
But yeah, you're right, because at the end of the previous book, we have this big, you know, cliffhanger of Riven betrays everybody.
Dun, dun, dun.
Right. And then the intro of the third book is, but it's okay because it was all part of the secret plan that was even kept a secret from them using their crazy psionics.
Right.
Which actually kind of worked for me. I mean, you're right. There was a little bit of that kind of thing going on, right, where there was this plan that we didn't know about. But I felt like that was sort of intentional. You know, that wasn't an accidental, you know, it wasn't him, it wasn't the author using a deus ex machina or whatever to fix something. It was, look, I hinted that there was something going on that you don't know about earlier.
Right.
And now it played out.
Right, and during the last book club episode, we talked about a little bit how, you know, I didn't felt right that this happened. So, mm-hmm. You know, the fact that I picked up on that, and I'm not saying that everyone would, but or anything like that, but the fact that I did made it a little more palatable, at least to me. It wasn't like, because sometimes you want to create that trust with the narrator, mm-hmm. or the voice of the story, and to have the voice of the story, like, it suddenly change on you can be kind of disconcerting. But it was already a little disconcerting. Like, you knew something had to be going on, but you had no idea what. And I kind of liked that. I think it worked too.
Yeah, yeah, actually, and the whole trilogy worked that way for me, where at the end of every trilogy, I was like, you know, there was just this one thing that really didn't sit well for me that kind of bothered me, and then chapter one of the next book totally fixed it, you know? In book one, it doesn't make any sense to me why Slotty, knowing what I know about Slod, why they would be involved in this kind of thing at all, you know? And then the introduction of book two totally explains it, and it made sense. You know, and then the end of book two, it was the betrayal by Riven, like you said, didn't really quite feel right, didn't sit well. And then the introduction of book three totally made it make sense, you know, and it just sort of became sort of the formula of this whole trilogy.
Right.
Right on.
And there was one person in that group that didn't know, and they didn't need to do their badass psionics on, and that was Jax.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, I actually found... one of my issues, I guess, with the whole trilogy is that I really wanted to feel connected to Jack because that connection is important as you go through the series and especially as you get into the end. But I never really did, you know, because almost from the moment we met him in the first book of the trilogy, he had been broken, you know. We never really got to know Jack as normal Jack.
Yeah, and he always... So he developed a little bit, but he often had that childlike quality to him that can be kind of disconcerting, at least to me, in an adventure series. The person that's too trusting and then, you know, has the trust broken, so then they go in the opposite direction. Mm-hmm. And there's not as much middle ground or nuance there.
Right. Although I did like the growing relationship between Jack and Riven.
Right.
And I like that by the end of this book where, you know, again, we're not going to care about spoilers here, where Jack dies, that Riven actually cared. And I felt like that was true to Riven. You know, I feel like Jack being around and even in death now is good for Erebus Kale and Riven.
You know, right.
I think it pulls them both in the direction of good, even though he's not even there anymore.
Right. And I thought how they handled the scene with Jack with his parents and everything else after he died mm-hmm. was kind of interesting, too, because, you know, on one hand, they were saying, well, Jack in life had said that he would never want this. Mm-hmm. And then you see him in the afterlife type world, and it's like he's being pulled and he kind of wants to be pulled, but he's kind of okay where he is. But it's not as clear cut that no, I don't feel coming out of it that he definitely would not have wanted to be pulled back.
I don't think he would have wanted to be pulled back, and I think that the author made it pretty clear and foreshadowed it and laid out the groundwork for this early on in the book with the encounter with Sephiroth, the chosen of Ogma.
Oh yeah.
Where Ogma had been brought back from the dead, because the last time they'd seen him, he was dead, and now he's suddenly back. And, you know, I mean, Jack lays it right out right at that point. Now it's, you know, half a book away by the time when we're reading it, so you kind of forget about it when you get into that afterlife scene. But Jack had said, look, if I ever die and you have the opportunity to bring me back, don't. You know, and when Kale is in that moment, he has the opportunity to bring him back. And then thinks about Sephiroth and thinks about how Sephiroth did come back, and he came back out of a sense of duty because he felt like, you know, people expected him to, and people felt like they needed him, not because he wanted to. And that took him to a pretty dark place, and he didn't want to put Jack through that. And that felt good to me.
I don't know. I didn't get the same out of that chapter or that part of the chapter.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess the part that I liked and that felt good for me was the part with Kale more than the part with Jack.
I guess.
If that makes sense. You know, I understood and I liked Kale's reasoning as he was going through that process and then realized exactly what he was doing and then backed off on it and didn't do it.
Oh, yeah. No, totally. But I guess all I'm saying is that it's not like you have this chapter where Jack is completely happy where he is. Like, he's not unhappy, but he does have a sadness in that he feels like he's missing something.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so, yeah, I can see that. I mean, I don't know how much he feels like he's missing something or how much of it is he feels like his friends want him to be there and he wants to be there for them. You know what I mean?
Don't think he even remembers that.
I don't think he remembers consciously, but I think there's that subconscious that is what was pulling him back.
Okay.
But in any case, he dies.
He dies.
And it's supposed to be really sad, and I didn't care enough about him for it to be as sad as I think it was supposed to be.
You just don't like halflings.
I do like halflings.
I'm just joking.
I just felt like I needed more Jack to understand who he was, and maybe that again goes back to the idea that we started with this trilogy, and there were one one shot book and a short story,
or maybe, right.
maybe two one shot books or whatever. But there was more stories establishing Erebus Kale and Jack that we didn't read. So,
right.
One of the things that I thought this series did well, and is always sort of something I look for when I'm reading a specifically a Forgotten Realms book, but it could be, you know, any shared setting series. But because in the Forgotten Realms, more than any others, when an author writes a book, they're creating new canon for the setting, for the world, that everybody else has to sort of live in that world that's now been fleshed out and changed by that author, right? Whenever I'm reading those kinds of books, one of the questions I ask myself is, did this story have to be told in the realms? Or is this a story that the author wanted to tell and made it fit into the realms because realms books sell a little better? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm curious where you come down on this book in terms of, did this story have to take place in the realms, or was this just a story that Paul Kemp wanted to tell?
I'm not entirely sure. And part of the problem is just, I don't know which of the stuff from this is realms versus fantasy versus D&D.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like one issue. We were actually asking, Fred was asking me, I think yesterday or the day before, whether or not the Shadowfell was a realms thing. Or something else. And I honestly didn't know the answer to that. I didn't know where the Shadowfell ever came from.
Well, the Shadowfell is new for 4th edition. Prior to that, it was the Plane of Shadow.
Right.
Which was part of the general D&D cosmology.
Right.
Not just in the realms.
That's what I thought. That was my answer was, but I wasn't entirely sure.
And for any listeners who don't know, Fred is Tracy's husband.
Yeah, sorry. So there are lots of it where I didn't necessarily feel that it had to be realm specific. You know, a lot of it felt just fantasy like, with the fae spirit in the river. I mean, there are definitely settings that were chosen because they're part of the realms, but I don't know if it had to be told in the realms.
Okay. That's actually really interesting, because your response tells me, how accessible is this story to somebody who's not as caught up on the realms canon, right? And so it sounds to me like you think it's fairly accessible to you, even though you're not a big realms person. Is that accurate?
This was fairly accessible. I mean, there were definitely times when I wasn't sure if I didn't know something. We already have been over this, where I didn't know something because I didn't know about the realms, or it just wasn't something that anybody would necessarily know. Because as you said, that sometimes you're expanding the canon as you go. So,
right. No, that's right. And here's my response as somebody who is very familiar with at least much of the canon, I guess, of the realms. I'm not going to claim that I've read every realms novel, right? But I'm a fan of it, so I keep up with it quite a bit. And I thought this series did a nice job of sort of walking that line pretty well, of being accessible, but this is totally a realms book or a series. You know, I felt like this trilogy, this story had to be told in the realms, and use the things that the setting provides to make it a very realms story. You know, it involved realms gods. It involved not only realms settings, but you know, long-standing canon and mythology dealing with the mythals, which is a big deal of realms sort of thing, going way back.
You know. I might have also just missed all those references and didn't really care.
Right. No. Well, and
that leads to accessibility, I know.
Right, and I think that's fine. But I mean, and there are some really good realms novels that I've read. There's like that I felt like, you know, this was a really good trilogy. But this could have been almost anywhere, you know? But this series, I felt like this was a good realms series. Like, they were actually wanted to tell a story in this world, not just they wanted to tell a story and stuck it in this world.
Okay.
Although there it has its moments where it breaks from that a little bit, right? It's interesting because right now in D&D novels, there's a big event going on called the Abyssal Plague. And the big sort of surprising moment, I think, that a lot of people are taking away from this is that it's the return of the multiverse, right? It's the idea is that all of a sudden now all the D&D worlds are connected to each other, which they used to be, and then they stopped doing that for a long time, and then now they brought back the multiverse, so they're all connected. But I find it interesting because this trilogy which was produced in third edition, actually sort of implies a multiverse throughout several moments anyway, right? The main villain, the Sojourner, is not from the Forgotten Realms. He's from somewhere else.
Right.
When they, in the end of the first book, when they go to the Fane of Shadows, they go and see all of these different incarnations of gods of shadow, you know, most of which are not from the realms. And so as much as it felt very much like a realms book, it also embraces the idea of a multiverse where there's other things out there and uses that.
Yeah, see, I just wouldn't know.
Right on.
I'm not trying to be a liar, it's just that's... So unless you know what the realms is and stuff, it would be very difficult just reading the book without doing extra research to know what stuff was realm specific or not. And that's why I think it probably pulled in a lot of realm stuff, but the Forgotten Realms itself is built on this whole other network of fantasy archetypes and tropes and everything else that I think helped makes it accessible. So I felt this was more accessible to me than the Elminster book.
And that's awesome. I guess that's a win all around, because it's a pet peeve of mine when I read a Realms book that feels like it could have been told anywhere, right? I want a Realms book to embrace that setting, and not all the authors do.
Right.
And so I thought it was, but to be able to do that and make it accessible to you, I think is awesome.
Yeah. What did you think of the Sojourner's reason for wanting to destroy the world?
Well, it's funny, right? He didn't want to destroy the world at all. Presumably, outside of the few disasters perpetrated in order to harness the magical power he needed, his ultimate plan wasn't going to hurt the world at all, right?
Right.
He just wanted to be able to walk around outside before he died.
Yeah.
Which, honestly, I thought was kind of awesome. On one hand, I'm like, it's really cool because you have this totally epic character who just wants to do something really mundane, and he has to do these really epic things in order to do it. And it's sort of a nice little heartfelt personal story. There is a little sliver of, but I was really looking forward to something epic. And it was, he just wanted to go walking on the beach, you know?
I know. I made myself the enemy of the skulls for this.
Right. Well, but see, he didn't care, right? Because he can take all those people.
Well, no, but with Kale and whatnot, I mean, he loses Jack. He makes himself the enemy of the skulls for a while in Skullport. And all this other stuff that's that he has to go through that's crazy. And he becomes turns away from being human, becomes part shadow. Mm-hmm. All because this guy wants to go walk on the beach.
Right. No, if the heroes hadn't gotten involved at all, Skullport would have been severely destroyed, although it basically was anyway. And it's full of evil people, so you almost don't care. And then the Mythyl at Sackers, which is this city in the bottom of the ocean, was also destroyed, and it woke up the Kraken or whatever, which happened anyway, and didn't really hurt anybody. So ultimately, if they had just not gotten involved at all, you might have had a few extra Slod running around and causing trouble, but other than that, it honestly wouldn't have been that bad, right?
I thought the end would still have been bad with the eclipse being the moon being pulled in.
Oh, was it gonna be pulled in and crash into the earth or something?
I thought it was
because I never really felt like that was super clear. Maybe I just have blocked it.
I thought that was part of it.
I suppose. That sounds accurate, but I don't know.
Right.
I felt like mostly the reason that they were involved had nothing to do with they were actually needed to save the world. It was because Mask wanted Kale to go through all of this to make him into a better servant to Mask.
Well, and then also get the new home base.
Right, and Mask wanted to perpetrate this great theft of, I'm going to steal an entire temple of Sirik, who Mask is not friends with.
Which is, I think, pretty awesome, because it harkens back to the Greco-Roman gods always doing these weird things to each other and getting the humans to do it for them.
Mm-hmm. And again, on one hand, it harkens back to that, and it very specifically harkens back to the Avatar series. of Forgotten Realms books, you know, which sort of lays out the groundwork of this rivalry between Mask and Sirik.
Yeah, so yeah, and then that's the type of information that I don't have, but I can still pick it up from.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I think
he's pretty blatant about it.
Yeah. I mean, it's not. It didn't seem. It wasn't hidden. It wasn't subtle. So
no.
Right on. I guess any other thoughts about the book? It sounds like we enjoyed it.
Yeah, I think I like this one better than the other ones. Because it had a conclusion. That's one problem sometimes I have with trilogies. It's like I want each book to have a conclusion, and sometimes, like with they did but they didn't sort of thing. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I mean, he knew he was doing a trilogy, so he kept leaving you on cliffhangers.
Right.
So no, I get that. I thought this was probably the best of the books. If nothing else, I thought the pacing of this book was far and away the best.
Right.
It wasn't, you know, half a book of wandering around trying to figure out where to go and what to do. It was they had a task and they kind of knew what they were doing from the beginning. They were moving towards that. I thought the pace, you know, I moved through the book really fast. I don't know page count wise if it was shorter. I know it was fewer chapters. I don't know if it was actually shorter. But I mean, I've moved through this book significantly quicker than I did the previous books. You know, I thought the second book sort of hit a lull and I had to force myself to get through sort of that hump. And the first book I thought was a good introduction that got me hooked into it. But this book, I think, was certainly the climax that I think hit it all home.
Yeah. And I think the ending does give a good example with, you know, some people in their D&D campaigns, they want to get the players to do something other than kill everything in sight. So it gave, like, Erebus had something he had to do, even though that meant leaving, you know, the other guy still alive.
Yeah, and in fact, they ended up doing a lot of that. I mean, there was a lot of moments of, you can't kill the bad guy.
Right.
So you better just run, or you better just deal with it, or whatever, right? They couldn't kill the Sojourner multiple times. They couldn't kill him. They couldn't kill the Kraken, you know? There were all these things that they had to deal with or run away from, but they couldn't kill him.
Right. Which I like.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
And then sometimes it's, you know, hey, look, there's a bunch of sea trolls, let's slaughter them all. And that works too.
Or release the Kraken so they run.
Yeah.
Oh, they're running away. Look. Oh, crap.
Hey, there's that huge Kraken with a mythal creating gem stuck in its skull. That looks awesome. Let's not be here anymore.
I don't think that's level appropriate. I think our DM has it out to get us.
I think so. See, I think if I tried to pull that in my game, my players would end up dead because they'd try to fight it.
Sweet.
When we come back, we're going to talk to Paul Kemp.
So before we head out to talk to the author, Paulus Kemp, we need to mention our sponsor, Noble Knight Games. Noble Knight's a game store, both online and real world, and they specialize in finding out-of-print games just for you. Our pick of the episode is Shadow's Witness, one of the books that's a one-shot from the Symbian series that introduces us to Erebus Kael. So you probably know a little bit more about this than I do, right?
I have not read it.
Okay.
So I don't know too much about it. I mean, other than what Paul has sort of told us in previous interviews, that this is the book that he sort of used to test out this character, and from there, Watsy liked what they saw and let him do the trilogy.
Sweet. So yeah, so as you said, it's also by Paul. And if you enjoyed this series of books from the book club and you want to see how it all got started, head to Noble Knight Games where they have the out-of-print novel for $5.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
And now we are here with Paul S. Kemp, author of Midnight's Mask, as well as the previous two books that we've read. Welcome back to the show, sir.
Hi, thank you. It's great to be here.
So we looked at Midnight's Mask in this month's book club. This uh-huh. is your conclusion to the Erebus Kale trilogy, mm-hmm. Which was published how long ago originally?
I think Midnight's Mask was 06.
06?
And yep, so 5 years.
And you've published another trilogy and an extra a fourth book as well since then. Is that right? Following Erebus Kale?
There has been a subsequent trilogy, The Twilight War, which is made up of Shadowbred, Shadowstorm, and Shadow Realm. And there will be a subsequent trilogy called The Cycle of Night. The first book of that is called Godborn, and that will be released in late 2012, I recently learned.
Okay. So is Erebus Kale your Drizzt? Will his stories just go on forever, or is this a trilogy of trilogies that'll finish up soon?
I can't answer that question without spoiling considerable things from the next trilogy.
Okay. I see. But in many regards, you could definitely consider Midnight's Mask to be the conclusion of the introduction of this story.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's right.
Okay. When you originally wrote it, did you know that in your head you wanted it to be an introduction?
No, I didn't. I mean, let me take that back. I guess when I'm writing any book, even if I'm just writing, even if it's a standalone, I'm always trying to layer it enough and make the story hopefully rich enough with a few sort of loose ends such that if opportunity presents itself, I can continue that story in some way, or at least continue with the characters, because you kind of get attached to them. In the case of this trilogy, I didn't know anything would be continuing after it. I'd hope so, but you know, what I did is the same thing I do when I'm writing a standalone. I just did it in this case over the course of three books, which is craft some strands into the story that I can ultimately build on for a subsequent story. So for the next trilogy, for example, Magadan plays a key role. His whole storyline is critical to the next trilogy.
Yeah, and I almost feel like this is a story about, I mean, you've got this whole storyline focusing on Kale coming to terms with being a chosen of Mask and how that process happens of him becoming a chosen.
Yes.
But I still don't necessarily feel like at the end of this trilogy that he's really come to terms with it. You know, he still hasn't embraced his chosen-dom.
No, I think you're right about that, and in fact, that's really my intent. And that kind of the theme there is sort of twofold. It's kind of a fate versus determinism, and he choice versus determinism, and he's very much on the end of sort of individual will and choice. But he seems to be confronted constantly with these facts that would lead a reasonable observer to conclude that certain things are just predetermined and you're stuck, and he resists this constantly. Then there is also this sort of additional theme of the role that religion plays in an individual's life, and he's having to face that all the time, too, and the kinds of constraints that may put on him, on his behavior, or more importantly, the kinds of requirements that it may demand of him. And, you know, one of the things I really wanted to do, and Ed Greenwood does this really well, too, is if you go the route of a chosen, of a deity, gamers tend to think of that as like, wow, that's just so awesome because it means, you know, you've got some cool powers or something. But from a storyteller's perspective, that's just an enormous burden to have to carry. And what I tried to show earlier with Sephiroth, for example, the mathematician sage earlier in the series and who shows up in Midnight's Mask 2, is that the price of chosendom is very, very high. And not just the psychological toll, although that's obvious in the case of Sephiroth and even obvious in the case of Kale, but, you know, people will respond to you in certain kinds of ways and put certain kinds of demands. So Sephiroth, for example, yeah, he's a chosen, but he's essentially isolated. You know, his life is essentially dictated for him by the powers that be in his church, and on top of that, he's arguably nuts. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that I wanted to address, and those kinds of things continue on into the next series, too. In fact, they become much more acute for Kale in that some of his interactions with Mask in the next trilogy are very personal.
Very nice. So, you mentioned Sephiroth and the idea of continuing threads. If I'm remembering right, when they run into Sephiroth in Midnight's Mask, he mentions that Kale will basically be involved in some sort of disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's not really a way of there not being a disaster. It's just a matter of who's going to be affected by the disaster.
Mm-hmm.
Who was affected by the disaster, or have we not seen it yet?
I almost want to say I like to leave it to the reader's interpretation. If you presume that this trilogy represented the events of which Sepphoris was speaking, then there are a couple of candidates, I suppose, we could think about, or even, you know, if you think about, although the effects of this aren't made clear in the books, they sort of appear indirectly in later source books, what the Sojourner brings about is what subsequently comes to be known in around the Intersea region as the Rain of Fire, and this has relatively profound effects on some of the regions around there. But in my own mind, from my perspective, the actual cataclysm that Kale is destined to be a part of, cause and or instigate, is happens in the next trilogy.
Okay, so that was you laying some groundwork that could play out later.
Yeah, like I say, the nice thing about prophets is that they're always right, depending upon your point of view. So, you know, Sepphoris doesn't give, you know, the kind of detail of one goes, oh, it's clearly that. It's one of those things, you know, like the Oracle at Delphi or something, where, you know, subsequent events, when you reinterpret events in light of some ambiguous language, things seem to make perfectly good sense. But using that information beforehand is awfully difficult.
Right, and it's kind of like also how we have to be, people have to be careful when they talk to people they think are prophets or can see the future or talk to the dead or something, because we want that, we want to make the connection for them, so.
Yeah, that's right. You're right.
And Sepphoris has an interesting arc as you go through this trilogy as well, because he starts almost, he almost has a moment in the first book of being a little bit of a comic relief because of his insanity. But he very quickly becomes tragic, and then in the in the third book when he reappears, he's so much more tragic.
Yes,
but in a way that you've skillfully set him up to inform events later on with Jack.
Yes, yeah, that's right. You got it.
Okay. Good. I've successfully read the book. So one of the things I mentioned as we discussed this book is the idea that it's I'm a Forgotten Realms fan, so I read a lot of Forgotten Realms books. One of the things that I always sort of look at, and sometimes it bothers me, and sometimes I'm willing to get over it or whatever, is this a story that needs to be told in the realms? You know, is this really a realm story, or is this a story that they made work into the realms? I'm curious what your take on writing in the realms is and how you go about the process of making it a realm story rather than a story that just happens to be in the realms.
Oh, you know, I do that because I've played it, you know, in the case of particularly with this trilogy, but this is true of the Star Wars books I write too. Mm-hmm. I get fairly invested in the setting, and I like to think that I get to know it really well, I like to think, anyway, which doesn't cause me to sometimes deviate from some of the things that I could give you an example out of Midnight's Mass, for example, that irritated some of the people who really got into the lore in a way, and I made a decision to move away from it. But that aside, what you try to do anytime you're writing in a shared setting is get to know the setting really, really well. You come up with the kernel of the story idea, but then as that kernel starts to grow and flower into something more layered, richer, you try to nest it in the details of the setting. So, for example, you know, obviously Sepphoris as a Chosen of Ogma is something that squares fairly well with the realms in the way that he's presented. Mask as, because, you know, clearly religion plays a big role here, Mask as a schemer and so forth, works quite well in that regard. Skullport is a uniquely Realmsian kind of setting. Sembi is a uniquely Realmsian kind of setting and so forth. So, you know, you try to take all of those things, put them together into a coherent story, and then still, though, and this is always going to be the case, I think, when you're telling any kind of story, because you need to make the story yours. You want it to have, at least I do, I want it to have a style that's mine. So I'm not timid about either deviating a little bit from the lore if I really need to, although I'm careful about that, and bringing into building on pre-existing lore without running contrary to it. So, for example, the Sojourner's entire background obviously is not, he's multispheric in any event, so he's not Faruni in any meaningful way. But, you know, his whole backstory is something that we invented. You know, we created that. It's consistent with the history of the Gith and their rebellion against the Mind Flayers, but it takes a kind of a strand that's never been developed before. So he was brand new. The Sikors and the Mithilar there, that's something that was brand new. And in fact, this is the one area where some people who were really into the lore were annoyed with me, because Sikors, according to one source, was kind of essentially just reduced largely to rubble and nothing else over a fairly wide stretch of the bottom of the Inner Sea. And I said, I don't want to do that. I'm going to have a long stretch of rubble, but I'm still going to have a relatively coherent core that the source that mentions there's been nothing more than rubble must have missed. So, you know, that's the way you do it.
Okay.
You just know the setting and you try to weave it in.
And I found it interesting because, one of the big deals, I guess, in novels right now that WotC has going on is this Abyssal Plague. And one of the big sort of wow moments of it is when people realize it's the return of the multiverse.
Okay.
Which it seems, you know, that's so what you were doing 10 years ago, right?
Yeah, you know, I'm going to tell you that I haven't read any of the Abyssal Plague novels. So,
okay.
So I'm going to take your word for it and say yes.
Okay.
That's exactly what I was doing 10 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, because, I mean, the Erebuskill trilogy acknowledges the concept of a multiverse, whether it be in the Fane of Shadows, where there's all these gods from other worlds, or whether it's the fact that the Sojourner is not actually from the Forgotten Realms at all.
Right. Well, you know, that wasn't, I mean, thinking back to that period of time, that wasn't a particularly controversial stance to take back then. It wasn't the case that people regarded Toril and the Forgotten Realms as completely isolated from the rest of the multiverse. They may not have crossed streams very often as such, but I think that the concept was there. I mean, you know, in some of the earliest sources, Elminster, in the old Dragon articles and so forth, and they're a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but not entirely. You know, Elminster was supposed to have had interactions both on our Earth and with some of the more powerful mages, Morden, Kanan, and the like out of Greyhawk. So, so I mean, you know, it wasn't kind of a brand spanking new thing. It might not have been to such a degree, I suppose, but I don't think it was all that groundbreaking.
No, but it was just interesting for the time period that it came out, because I think it seemed like at the time WotC was avoiding the concept of discussing these settings, sort of crossing the idea of being able to cross settings, you know?
That's possible, Jeff. You might be right about that.
I don't know. Maybe I'm remembering it the way I want to, too. I don't know.
Well, you know, I mean, what happens is, I mean, Phil Athens was my editor, and Phil really gave me a lot of freedom with creating the stories, both in terms of tone and so, because I mean, frankly, in the next trilogy takes it up even a notch, I suppose. But you know, a lot of people were relatively uncomfortable with the tone of the Kale novels. They felt very dark to them. They were sort of like, I want to say, sort of like a, I'm going to say Conan, but that's something I'm flattering myself. I don't mean it that way. I just mean the tones are that, you know, if you read a Conan story, they kind of have this this very sword and sorcery. Everything's dirty. You know, magic is this kind of, notwithstanding the fact it's very common and fair, and it's kind of this mysterious, potentially sort of a dark force at work in the world and so on. So, you know, the Kale books kind of went in that direction, and there was at least a little bit of a pushback on that when it came to whether or not that fit really well with the realms. And my view and Phil's view was always that, you know, the realms is so big, so vast, and it has so much flavor and rich history that it can accommodate essentially any kind of story. I just tried to take care to keep it fairly narrow in its focus, so that, you know, it's always just like, look, what you're seeing here is just a slice of the realms through the eyes of these two or three guys who move in these dark places. So their world does look dark, and the people that they interact with are sort of these dark, gritty, kind of, you know, teeth rotten, nasty tempered dudes. Mm-hmm. But you know, the realms writ large can, you know, has its places of light and chivalry and knights and so forth. And those are maybe even more common. They're just not apparent in this first trilogy.
Sure. Although
we get a bit of that in the second trilogy.
Yeah, and one of the things when I read the first book of the trilogy, it was to the point that I wasn't even sure that I was going to like Kael, right? Because he wasn't really a good guy. He was at best a neutral guy, wavering between who he wanted to be.
That's right.
By the end, I feel like there's still an element of that, but he's certainly leaning more good than not. And to the point that even Riven, who was the devil on the shoulder, as we discussed it in the first book,
right,
turns into not so bad a guy himself.
No, you're right, and that's the whole point of we can talk spoilers, right?
Yeah.
The whole point of Jack's death and so on, when I don't recall if it's Kael or if it's Riven, but one of them says memories haunt better than ghosts, because it's Jack's memory now that's moving both of them in a certain direction. What he couldn't do in life, his memory is managing to do after his death.
Mm-hmm.
So both of them move a little bit more in that direction. You're right.
Well, and I decided that Riven couldn't be that bad of a guy when we found out about the dogs.
Well, see, the whole thing, that's a not uncommon trope to show that the bad guy is not a terrible guy. Mm-hmm. You know, you can show him with a dog, or you can show him with children or with women, although the whole point with Riven, you know, I'm actually doing an interview with someone else a written interview on anti-heroes, fairly lengthy one, so I've had occasion to think a lot about Riven and Kael over the course of this. And, you know, you guys probably never read the very first books featuring Kael and Riven, because they're kind of hard to find now. They'll be out on Kindle soon, but they're not yet, so they're difficult to find. But Riven is really, as an initial matter, he's pretty stone-cold killer, kind of vicious dude. At least that's the way he comes across to the reader. But always throughout, you know, when I have key characters, I sort of go through this exercise. I have a fairly complex character sketch, and his background and childhood was such that he's always going to be really soft-hearted, both to children and to dogs, and to a lesser degree to women, because of his mother. And you know, once you see some of that, you go, "Oh, okay." So he's not, you know, the guy who's going to stab you through the eye all the time and pick your ear off. He's a guy who's got a little more depth and a little more to him. His interactions with Kael and Jack start to round the end of his dark side also, although he holds on to it much more than Kael, because I mean, at the end of the day, he's just more comfortable with it. He's kind of okay with the ground he stands on. Kael never is. He always wants to sort of move one direction or another, and so that creates this internal tension for him. But Riven, he's sort of okay. His problem generally is one that it's not that he's uncomfortable with himself, it's that he gets uncomfortable with himself relative to other people. So when he sees Kael as a rival, which he does for much of the book until they finally settle in, there's some hostility there and so on. Whereas with Kael, it's not so much that he sees Riven as a rival, it's just that he's struggling internally all the time to figure out if he's standing on the right ground.
Okay, good. Tracy, I don't mean to be hogging all the time. If you've got questions, jump in.
Oh, I will. I guess one of the things that I found interesting, because I feel like they've gone away from it, was just how involved the gods were in...
Mm-hmm.
In kind of like in an old Greco-Roman sort of way, where they were kind of playing the people for their own amusement or own desires.
That's a keen observation. That's true. I mean, there is some of that going on, and that obviously informs the story and the writing to some degree. I like the idea. Religion plays a big role for me in all of my books, but I like the idea of, it seems sensible to me that gods, to the extent they can, will use their instruments, particularly their real sharp-edged, sort of powerful instruments, to try to sort of accomplish their aims. Now, Math's aims here aren't very clear, other than that he's establishing Kael and Riven for something, and that something comes up in the next trilogy. But he obviously was interested in sort of winning both of them and bringing both of them to some form of accommodation where they could work together. That was really, to the extent he has a sort of an unspoken goal in the book, that's what it is, and that gets accomplished. And then in the next trilogy, as I say, that becomes a bit more apparent. terms of the kinds of things that they do. But yeah, I like the idea of having gods fiddle around through their agents and try to accomplish their aims. I mean, especially when you have such a really interesting, rich pantheon like you have in the realms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's always been one of my favorite types of at least in terms of D&D novels. I always like it when the gods get involved and start messing with people.
I'll tell you, honestly, the map is better than this one. Partially that's because I had more words I could work with, so you know I didn't have to shoot for that 90,000 kind of word count, which is a kind of standard novel size. I could go longer than that, which I did. And I also had a bit more room to play with in terms of subject matter. It's really a nice, I would say, I think the Kale trilogy is so, it's very character focused and it's very much it really squares with kind of sword and sorcery sensibility. The next trilogy does that also, but kind of edges up towards epic fantasy in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most people who have read all the books, I think, like the second trilogy more. But not all. I mean, I have heard from people who say, no, I like the first one more because it was so focused on the characters and so on.
Sure.
This one is too. The next one is too, but it has some bigger things going on also, which I found interesting to write. It was a real fun challenge. Anyway, I don't get too far afield, but I know we're talking about a different Midnight's Master, not the next trilogy.
Right. But you've got me anxious to want to go read it.
Oh, I think. Well, listen. I don't want to try to sell you on it. I know you got a lot of stuff to do, but if you read the first chapter and see if you're sold, and then after that. Because you can see what's happened to Kale over the course of a year after losing Jack and separating from Riven, and settling into a relationship with Vara, and you can see how things have taken out.
Well, and I'm glad you brought up Vara because that was one of my questions, because the relationship that was built in the second book, right, or that started at least there,
right,
with Vara, always felt a little. Incomplete, I guess. It wasn't really, you know, it never really had time to develop and happen in front of us. And to the point that Kale even sort of mentions it towards the end of Midnight's Mask.
Right.
That it, you know, he doesn't know why he feels connected to this woman, but he does. Is that something that's going to play out, or are we just are we going to have an idea of why that was so abrupt and why that happened so quickly?
Well. It's kind of hard to answer. I mean, my view, there's nothing. I think the question you're asking is there like some deeper connection to the two of them from a story perspective that something go, oh, that makes sense. Like, you know, they were past lives, lovers or something like that.
Or is it there's just love at like, first sight or, you know?
Yeah. There's nothing like that. It's always been my view, particularly with guys like Kale. I think, you know, whose passions run really kind of hot, even though they kind of keep him suppressed. I feel like he's the kind of guy, because he did this with Tavy and Escaverin too, although, I mean, they had a longer, by virtue of their contact in the Escaverin household, but he's the kind of guy who can fall hard. And I don't mean that in a superficial way either. I just mean that he's the kind of guy who feels a connection, and when he does, then things can happen, and I thought Vara would be his similar in terms of their psychology, and just from my own personal perspective, I think that does sometimes happen. People can just sometimes connect in weird ways, you know, whatever their particular neuroses are, just vibe, man, and they can just, you know, spend a few minutes together, and all of a sudden they just know that this is somebody they could spend a lot of time with. So I just sort of took that and went with it. But there's no, like, super deep kind of story connection. There's just this kind of complementary psychology that seems to work well for the two of them. So we get a bit more of Vara in the next trilogy yet. But we don't get, you know, there isn't any big secret that lies there. I concede that their relationship is an abrupt one. It's just one, I just think that can happen, so I was okay with it. But I certainly understand when some people, I don't know, if I'm not really a love at first sight kind of person. I don't think that flies.
Tracy, I think I interrupted you. You were going to ask something?
I'm trying to remember. Sorry. we can talk about something else, though, in the meantime.
Okay. You mentioned that the idea of Sackers is something that rubbed some people the wrong way because it didn't quite flow with their vision of continuity.
Mm-hmm.
Oddly enough, Sackers didn't bother me at all. But one of the things that for a moment I had to stop and think about it was when Jack died.
Mm-hmm.
There was no fugue plane.
Say that one more time.
There was
the fugue plane. Right.
There was no fugue plane. He just went straight to the afterlife.
Right, this is sort of my take on that. I'm aware of the fugue plane, but my thought was, look, when someone dies, you know, time relative to the prime material plane, let's say, ceases to exist. There isn't, you know, time doesn't pass the same in the fugue plane as it does in the prime material plane. So it's very possible that Jack went through the fugue plane and was there for a very long time before he was finally plucked by Brand of Barris or his minions from the wall and sent to the Happy Hunting Grounds or wherever the halflings go after that. So I was okay with that. You know, I was like, you know, I wanted to get to the emotional core of that scene. I didn't want to have to spend a bunch of time with that. So you're right. I mean, I definitely just bypassed it altogether. But in my own mind, I thought the bypass was okay. Or at least I had an intellectual construct to rationalize the bypass.
Sure. Well, and the way you did it certainly made better literary sense, right? Because you were trying to make a specific point at that moment in the story. And it works,
that's right.
It works better with him being in the afterlife with his dead relatives and whatever than it does if he's waiting around the fugue plane.
Yeah, no, that's right. And that's one of the key things, you know, when you're writing a story in a shared world or in a kind environment like this. And you have to be careful here, but my goal, I feel like my responsibility to the reader is to just try to tell a story that I can tell. I do want it to be a great realm story and all of that, but fundamentally, I need to tell a great story, something to keep somebody wanting to turn pages or feel in the characters and so forth. And sometimes that does mean taking some liberties, with some of the lore, not touching all of the bases in the case of the fugue plane, for example, or with spores or with, you know, having a sentient psionic mythologue and so forth. So, you know, there you go.
For what it's, and I mentioned it earlier in the episode, but for what it's worth, I felt like you did a better job than some of the maybe the better known writers in the realms. I thought you did a better job of making it a realm story while being able to tell your own story within it. So,
I appreciate that.
I commend you for that. It felt very like I didn't feel like this story could have been told anywhere except the realms, which is one of the questions I always have to ask myself.
Well, that's good. Thank you.
So I kind of remember what my point was. It's been a long time since I've taken an English or literature class, so I might get the terms wrong. But in the trilogy, there's sort of like this unreliable narrator for a degree, because you hide some stuff from the reader and then you hint at it and then you bring it out. Like, what types of were you concerned about that? Are there things you have to keep in mind when you're trying to do a story like that?
Well, give me an example, because and here's the reason I asked. I think the notion of an unreliable narrator is one. I suppose that's a fair way to characterize it. But the way I generally think about an unreliable narrator is someone who is communicating the events that they see, but what they see is being deliberately skewed or filtered subconsciously for whatever a reason that will later be revealed. And
right.
I'm trying to think of where I might have. Might have done that. I do. There are times when you have to you structure a scene such that the narrator is only to the extent we're in the narrator's head and we're getting some kind of internal monologue or he's seeing some things where the narrator only sees or presents things that are meaningful to the narrator at that moment, but the facts that are presented are accurate. It's just that they may not be all of the facts, maybe because they're not relevant to the narrator at that point, or you cut the scene short before there's some reveal that you want to reveal later for dramatic effect.
Right.
Yeah, so I mean, you do have to be, you know, you want to be careful with that, obviously, because, and that's why I was going to give an example, but you want to be careful with that because, you know, you don't want to, you can't be dishonest with the reader,
right?
Obviously, and you don't want them to yanking their chain for the sake of, you know, some big wow or punch to the gut later. So, you know, with regard to the big thing, and maybe this is what you mean, is with the Sojourner's goals. how he sort of euphemistically refers to what he's searching for as this ring of fire and sort of assume that it's ring and that kind of thing. Is that who you were thinking of?
No, actually, I was thinking because Riven, they kind of made a pact and then wiped their own minds. So when Riven does turn against Kale,
yes,
we don't know. I at least
right,
didn't
right.
Know.
Okay, yeah, no, that actually is a good example. Although that sort of finesses the unreliable narrator a little bit, doesn't it? Because Riven isn't. He's not unreliable as such. I mean, I guess he is in a way, because that scene does take place offline.
Right.
Or at least out of sight, you know, where Meg does the mind wipe and all that.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that it was exactly right, and that's why, it's been a while, so I don't know the exact term, but it kind of starts to get to that place, because we want to believe what they're telling us as we're reading it. Like, we want to believe what we're seeing.
Right.
But at some point we realize that even though we're seeing it and everything that's being described is actually what happened, but we're missing this critical piece of information that they wiped their minds.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah, you're right about that. That's definitely a fair critique if that bugs somebody. I think the way I tried to deal with it, and I think even when we talked after last book, you guys had your suspicions because of the scene that happens in the Plane of Shadows,
mm-hmm.
is you try to plant the seed there. You know, it's a bit like Chekhov's rule that the gun that appears in Act 1, you know, if it's going to kill somebody in Act 3, it better appear in Act 1, that kind of thing. You want to plant the seed there so that a reader doesn't feel cheated. But at the same time, it's a fine line. I mean, because I don't want it to feel like a dishonest thing to have done to a reader. But at the same time, since I tell the story in sort of tight third person, it would be difficult to tell a kind of a mind wipe sort of scene and then thereafter have the story go forward with the narrators not knowing that the mind wipe has occurred, but the readers knowing it. It would just be a weird way to do it. So to structure it the way that I did is kind of a way of putting the reader in the position that the characters were in. In that, you know, they don't know that their minds have been wiped. The reader doesn't know, but I tried to provide enough information that they could have a suspicion, and a lot of readers did, partially because they liked Riven by that point and they didn't want to be a bad guy, but also because of that scene. And then hopefully that's enough to make them feel like, oh, okay, yeah, I knew that was coming, or you know, that was a reasonable way to present it. But no, yeah, it's absolutely an issue that you need to be conscious of and be careful with. So yeah. I try to be careful with it. Whether I was is for each reader to decide.
Yeah, I thought you were. I happen to actually like some of those things because I don't care as much about that fourth wall issue. So
uh-huh.
One of my favorite shows is Leverage, and Leverage is all about how, you know, you're like, how in the world are they going to get out of this situation? And then they show how they actually had it planned all along, or
right.
You know, so, and I have to like that sort of thing.
Well, that's good. I'm glad. You know, you're kind of the Ocean's 11 type of thing where you're like,
exactly.
Yeah. No, I like that stuff too.
Yeah,
it was good.
It actually fit. I noticed a bit of a formula as I was reading the books and I mentioned this to Tracy earlier, where at the end of the first two books, there was just something that didn't sit right with me. And then the introduction of the next book totally fixed it every time.
Well, that's good. That's definitely what you want to do. I mean, you know, what you always want to do as a writer too is have people engaged enough that they're thinking about it, or that they feel like you felt, Jeff, where you're like, you know, what in the hell? That doesn't make sense, or that doesn't quite work. And why would they behave that way? And then, as you say, you fix it. You obviously don't want something like that to linger, because then it just festers and ruins enjoyment of the book. But if you can get people thoughtful about the book, where they're thinking about behaviors and motivations and so on, and why things are happening the way they're happening, and then resolve that for them in a satisfying way. Those are kind of like little milestones along the way that are fun for readers.
Yeah. And I did
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I did like the Ring of Fire one too.
Yeah, that was nice.
Well, see, what I was going to say there is that was the big one that I was frankly really, really nervous about when I was writing that trilogy, because that's one where I felt like I was being a little sneaky, but I wanted to be sneaky in part. I think fairly sneaky, but I don't mean fairly sneaky, like moderately sneaky. I mean, I was sneaky in a fair way. because, you know, the way the Sojourner thought about those, that kept his scenes really short most of the time, and the way that he thought about it was in this sort of boyish way. And the whole point of this trilogy was to take this, well, this wasn't the point, but one of the big things with the big bad evil guy here was to take the kind of standard world-dominating motivation of the omnipotent, really powerful bad guy and turn that on its head such that this being with enormous personal power who's dying wants nothing more than just to relive a moment that he had in his boyhood. It so happens that it's going to cause enormous damage and death in the process, and he doesn't really care about that because his moral code is funny. Mm-hmm. But the idea was to take, you know, I don't want to use $5 words like subvert, you know, tropes and so on, but the idea was just to sort of flip that on its head a little bit and have what I think is a fairly unusual motivation for a big antagonist like the Sojourner. People seem to really an enormous amount of fan mail about the Sojourner and how that worked itself out.
Yeah, and that was an interesting little twist because on one hand it made this story that was in our head the whole time, this big epic end of the world sort of thing, and it suddenly made it feel a lot more like a small little personal story.
Right, makes it more appalling in a way. You know, you're thinking this guy is prepared to kill hundreds, thousands of people for something to get to an outside observer looks trivial.
Yeah.
But to him meant an awful lot. And I tried to suggest that either in Dawn of Night or at some point when Cale and Riven are talking, and Riven says, nothing's more important than the personal. And the idea there was just to foreshadow this notion that the Sojourner's goals were these entirely small personal kinds of stakes, mm-hmm. notwithstanding the enormity of the methods he was using.
Right. Well, good. Tracy, you got any last things? We've been talking for a good 37 minutes now on the clock. So.
I don't think so. I mean, I liked it overall, and I happen to like being... It's because I haven't read a lot of D&D novels, but I've read a lot of the foundational literature and that type of fantasy stuff, that it's hard sometimes for me to find a book that will trick me like that, and so I love it when I do.
No, that's good.
Very good. Paul, do you have any last things you wanted to say? This will be our last chat, and at least until we run into another one of your books.
Not really, except to say that, you know, if folks enjoyed the series, I think they'll enjoy the next one. And then once we get to Cycle of Night and Godborn, the Cycle of Night actually features Kael's son by Vara, who's the protagonist. So things get a little complicated, but I think, you know, throughout the course of your career as a writer, your writing's always maturing.
Mm-hmm.
And this was my first trilogy, and I think we talked last time, the second book, I felt like it suffered a lot from what second books and trilogies often suffer from, which is they're just bridge books. So, you know, you learn as you go, and as I've gone, I've tried to hone the craft all the time, and I think that the next trilogy reflects, you know, it's a step up in that regard. So to the extent anybody enjoyed this one, they'll enjoy that one.
Yeah, I know. I'm eager to get to it, and I got to figure out when I'm going to have the time because Tracy over here is making me move on to something else for our next month. So,
oh, that's cool. Yeah, rock on.
we're reading The Godcatcher by Aaron Evans.
Oh, that's great.
At least we're still in the realm.
Aaron's very nice. Oh no, and Aaron's great. So, and I've heard good things about that book. So, I think you guys will have a great time.
Very good. All right. Well, thanks for coming on again. We'll talk to you another time.
You bet. Thank you both very much. Have a great one.
All right. I want to thank our sponsor for the episode, Noble Knight Games, as well as our interviewee, the author, Paul S. Kemp, joining us for the third time in a row. We're going to give him a break for a while and move on to other things in the future, but I wanted to thank him for joining us three times.
Yeah, definitely. If you'd like to contact us with any questions, concerns, things that you'd like to tell Jeff about what type of Skittles to get me, you can email us at thetomeshow@gmail.com. You can visit us at the forums at gamershavenpodcast.com or call us on the biz line at 919-BIZ-TOME. That's 919-BIZ-TOME.
And all of the conversation over at the forum lately has been, where's our prizes? We did a contest. So...
We hear you.
I told them sort of what was going on, and they were all very understanding and very civil about it. I love our forum people and our audience. They've been great. But We are aware that we're about 2 months behind on announcing that, and I think we're almost ready to do that. In fact, it might happen before this episode comes out, so that'll be awesome. Beyond that, you can always find show notes for this and other episodes over at thetomeshow.com. And this has been our book club episode of Midnight's Mask by Paul S. Kemp. We took a nice stroll under the eclipse, and now it's time for it all to come to a close. Join us next time in the month of, what is this, September? Yeah, yep. September 2011, as we read The Godcatcher by Aaron Evans. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
I'm on the wall.